It was in the year that Uzziah died that these things took place, and that's an important little detail. In the year that Uzziah died, the king of Judah, when the things that happen when leadership is changed were taking place in Judah, and people were frightened, and people were anxious and wondering what would take place, and would the new king be as good as the old king? And it was in this time of unsettled worry that Isaiah saw the king. No, you didn't hear me. It was in the year that King Uzziah died that Isaiah saw the king. In the year that Uzziah died, Isaiah said, I saw the Lord, high and lifted up, the Lord God Almighty. And about him there were seraphim, there were angelic beings, literally, the word means burning ones, seraphim, burning ones, who had six wings, and with two wings they were covering their faces in humility, and with two wings they covered their feet, a euphemism for they covered their nakedness in humility, and with two wings they flew, and they called out to one another, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. Or did it sound like this? Holy, holy, holy. Or did it sound like this? Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory. This is the vision that that Isaiah saw in the year that King Uzziah died. He saw the Lord whose robe filled the entire temple. The hem of his robe filled the entire temple. And when the angelic beings, the seraphim, spoke, the whole temple shook at its foundations. All of it rumbled in its foundations. And the whole building filled with smoke. And there was a 37-minute power outage. This is first-person language that Isaiah is. This is the language of experience. This is the language of encounter that Isaiah is using in this text. This is language that stretches beyond the ability of language to speak. It is Isaiah attempting to give words to that which words simply cannot contain, words that are stretched beyond their normal usage. How in the world do you express this mystical encounter, this sacred encounter with holiness? How do you describe it? Holy, holy, holy. What do those words mean? The saints have been trying through all of history to try to describe what these words mean. Men and women and children who have had an encounter, the sacred encounter with God, have tried over and over and over to describe what this means. Holy means beautiful. Holy means light without darkness. Holy means reverent. Holy means powerful. Holy means good without a hint of badness. Holy means light and pure. And holy means holy. Holy is the word that the Bible uses to describe who God is, a word that is not descriptive of anyone else in any other way. Holy is just holy. And in the year that Uzziah died, Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up. His language is the language of encounter. This is not an observer. Notice, Isaiah did not watch the Lord. Isaiah saw the Lord. There's a difference. And so when the foundation was shaking, the temple was shaking at its foundations, and all of the temple was filled up in smoke, Isaiah threw his hands in his pockets and he said, cool, cool, cool. Nice show. Seraphim, could you do that? You guys are amazing. Could you manage to pull that off again? I have never seen a light and sound show quite like that one. Would you guys do that again? By the way, I need to pull out my cell phone and video the whole thing because my friends are not going to... No. When Isaiah saw the Lord, He spoke the only words that he was capable of speaking. He said, "Woe is me. I am a man of unclean lips, and I am of a people of unclean lips. Mine eyes have seen the Lord of glory. I am undone." You see, Isaiah could not even speak except for those words. He could not even join his lips to the words, "Holy, holy, holy," proclaimed by the seraphim. He could not even join in. I wonder what was going through his mind when he said, "I'm a man of unclean lips." Maybe he was thinking all of a sudden about some encounter that he'd had with his wife earlier that week when unnecessarily he spoke out of a moment of frustration and agitation, and he spoke words that he later regretted, harsh words. And maybe now Isaiah is thinking about those words. Or maybe he's thinking about when he was having coffee with his buddies at the main cafe, and the conversation turned to the town tramp, and everybody enjoys beating up on her. And so as they began gossiping about the town tramp, Isaiah joined right in. I don't know. Maybe Isaiah was thinking about that occasion when he found it so easy to speak mistruth because it made him look better. I don't know. But I do know that in this moment, Isaiah could not even speak except to say, "Woe is me. I am a man of unclean lips, and I am from a people of unclean lips, and I am undone because I have seen the Lord." There was a brilliant French philosopher named Blaise Pascal, a brilliant man, a little nerdy. Scientist, mathematician, he was one of those extraordinary people of his time who was just brilliant in so many different ways. In addition to being a scientist and a mathematician and a philosopher, Blaise Pascal also met the Lord. And he kept a little notebook of his experiences and his thoughts. He would write out scientific theories in this little notebook, and he would write out little philosophical fragments in this notebook. He called it pensées, which sounds like pensive, reflective. It was his reflections. And one day, Pascal wrote about the sacred encounter, and he encapsulated it in one word: fire. One word. Rudolf Otto was a theologian who did a lot of thinking about the encounter, the sacred encounter between humans and God, thinking about the experiences that people have had of the Holy One. And Rudolf Otto said, there seems to be two things that happen to people who encounter the Holy One. One is, he used Latin language, but the meaning of the words were, one is people who are compelled and drawn into the mystery of God. Mystery because they don't pretend to understand who God is. When we are encountered by God, all of our concepts of who God is, all of our little categories and understandings are somehow unacceptable. They're not even worthy of who God is. And he said, when people encounter God, the Holy One, they feel compelled and drawn like an extraordinary magnetism into the mystery and the beauty and the wonder of God. And he said, at the very same time, people seem to be frightened. Isaiah said it this way: "Woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I am from a people of unclean lips, and I have seen the Lord, and I am undone." How different that is than the spirit of much of our religion these days. May I be sober with you for just a moment? Allow me to just be honest. How different that is from the spirit of much of our religion these days, where our religion seems to be about, what we're going to get out of it. I was thinking this week about that old Greek myth. Some of you remember the story of Narcissus. You remember Narcissus? Narcissus was this mythological character of the Greeks who was extraordinarily beautiful. He was just beyond handsome. He was an incredibly handsome man, and he knew it. And he disdained everyone else because nobody was nearly as beautiful as he was. And his adversary led Narcissus to a pool of water where he leaned over and he saw his own reflection. And he was so in love with himself and so overcome with his own beauty that he never left. And he literally died because he never again ate or had interaction with other human beings because he couldn't leave this reflection of beauty before him. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if here in the 21st century, here in North America, we are a generation of Narcissus goes to church. I think, allow me to just be sober for a moment, I think the company that has caught the spirit of our times maybe better than anybody else is Apple Computer. Wonderful products, by the way. I use them. But the marketing folks of Apple Computer at some point sat around tables and they tried to decide what to call all of their products so that they would really match the spirit of the times in which we live. And some genius at some point came up with the very simple word, I. You know where I'm going, don't you? And so they marketed the iPod. And now I don't have to listen to the crummy music that you listen to. You see, I could put my whole library right here on my iPod, and I can listen to the music I want, and I can have it tailored to my personal narcissistic self all the time. By the way, I have an iPod, and I like it. I'm not beating it up, but I just want you to notice what the marketing has done. iPod, and then there is the iPad. And the iPad allows me to work on my own little personal space, and all of the apps that I want to have on my iPad, I can have on my iPad, and I don't have to have your crummy apps or live with your crummy opinions. I get to have all of my iApps on my iPad, and then there is, of course, the iBook, and then there is, of course, the iPhone, and I'm wondering if one of our problems in the 21st century is that we now have iWorship. And so in our religion in the 21st century, we go to church. Notice the language. We aren't speaking about being the church. Instead, we talk about going to church, and I go to church, and I have all kinds of ideas about what it is that I want to get out of church. I am a consumer, and I want to consume what I want, and so I have an idea of the programs that I would like to have in church, and I'd like to have an idea of the kind of music that I want to have in church. And by the way, as we all know, it ought to be a 70s rock and roll beat, because that is God's favorite kind of music. We all know that. And I have ideas about the kinds of things that I want to take place and the kinds of people that I want to meet and the kinds of... And as Narcissus going to church, I go as an observer. You see, Narcissus wants to be entertained. He wants a show to take place. He wants things to happen that excite him and energize him and that entertain him and things that he likes. Narcissus wants to go to church, and he wants to be entertained. And so there's a stage, and there are people who are putting on a show for Narcissus, and he can sit back passively and enjoy. And the problem is that in the Bible, I think without exception, I can't think of a single one, in the Bible, when men and women and children are encountered by the Holy One, it changes the course of their lives without exception. Ask Abraham and Sarah. Ask Isaiah. Ask Moses. Ask Esther. Ask Mary, the mother of Jesus. Ask Peter and Andrew and James and John. Ask Mary Magdalene and Susanna and Joanna. Ask all of these people who encountered God, who had the sacred encounter with God, who were in the presence of God and knew that they were in the presence of God. You see, we will become like that which we worship. And when we worship the God and Father of Jesus, the God of Israel, the God whom Isaiah met and called holy, it cannot not change the course of our lives. And Narcissus is uncomfortable with that because he loves himself exactly the way that he is. So, Isaiah has cried out, I am a man of unclean lips, I am of a people of unclean lips. I have seen the Lord, I am undone. Now, at the entrance of the temple, there's an altar. And this altar has a fire that never goes out. At the base of this altar, the Levitical priests have been keeping a fire stoked year after year after year. This fire, according to the Old Testament, is never, ever, ever to be allowed to go out. This is the altar on which the burnt offerings and sacrifices are offered to God, the sin offerings offered on behalf of the people. Let me be clear, these burnt offerings are not at all like what happens frequently when I am the one who cooks. That's a different thing altogether. It has been described as a burnt offering. I want to be clear, this is a different thing altogether. And at the base of the altar, in the place where the sacrifices were offered, the priests would place large stones to hold the heat of the fire so that constantly they would hold the heat. These stones were red, fiery, hot coals. And when Isaiah had finished with his cry of dereliction, one of the seraphs flew from his place next to the throne of God and came to the altar and with tongs picked up this stone and brought this stone back to Isaiah and brought it to Isaiah's lips. He brought it to Isaiah's lips He brought it to Isaiah's lips and touched his lips with the stone. And the seraph said, "See now, the stone has touched your lips. You are forgiven. You are atoned." What a word, atoned. What a word. Look at that word. At one, atoned. This separation and distance, Isaiah, that you have encountered and experienced from God, this separation and distance is overcome now. You are at one through the fiery, red, hot forgiveness of God. Please notice, this is not overlooking. This is not, "Oh, Isaiah, it doesn't matter." No, 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 no. This is the fiery, red, hot forgiveness of God that grants at-one-ment between Isaiah and God. And this is the moment of Isaiah's calling. Isaiah now hears the voice. "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" It is the voice of God speaking on behalf of the heavenly host, the seraphim, and all others. "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And now Isaiah, whose lips have been cleansed and seared and purified, Isaiah says, "Here I am. I'll go. Send me." And just in case you haven't made the connections yet, I want you to be aware. This is Isaiah the prophet whom Jesus Christ quoted more than any other prophet. I don't know if it's fair to ask this question, but if you were to ask Jesus who was his favorite prophet, I think Jesus would have said Isaiah. He quotes him all of the time. If you were to ask the New Testament writers, who is your favorite of all of the prophets? I think the New Testament writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, all the others, I think they would have said, well, Isaiah, because he's the one he's quoting all the time. This is Isaiah, who will now leave this experience, and he will go out and with thundering voice will remind the people of God that if they continue following their idols, they're going to be destroyed by their idols. And then in the next words, Isaiah can be speaking some of the most powerful and beautiful and tender words that you've ever heard in all your life. Have you ever heard these? "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given." We read those words at Christmas time. That's Isaiah. Have you ever heard these words? "We will call him Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, and the government will be upon his shoulders." You know who spoke those words? That was Isaiah. Isaiah could thunder in one moment towards his people, reminding them that if they continue following their idolatrous ways, they're going to be destroyed. This is a word spoken in love for his own people. And then in the next word, Isaiah could look out over the many hills of history that are on their way to come. He could look toward the very last hill, the very last one, the time when God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And Isaiah could say, "The lion will lay with the lamb, and a little child will play over the top of the hole of a poisonous snake, because shalom will be all and in all." This is Isaiah that we're speaking about. And everything changed the day that Isaiah saw the Lord. And it will for us too. As you know, I've told you several times, several months ago, we met with together with the worship planning team to map out what we would like to do with this season of worship that we're ending this morning. And it seemed good to us to do a whole series around the idea of worship. And we called it Adoring Reverence. It seems to capture what it is that we want to be about in our worship as a congregation. And so we mapped out these five sermons, these five worship Sundays. And you'll remember that on the very first of these days, we looked at the worship that is taking place in heaven that John saw in the book of Revelation. And when they all shouted, "Worthy is the Lamb that is slain," we talked about our reverence for Jesus, the risen Lord. And then the next week, we looked at Moses, and we looked at the sacred encounter that Moses had at the burning bush when he took off his shoes because the place was holy ground, the sacred space of worship. And then the next week, we looked at the rhythms of worship, the rhythms of Passover and the Lord's Supper, and how the rhythms of worship through the course of the year bind us together with the whole story of God. And then on the next week, we looked at the Sabbath. We looked how the practice of Sabbath, the set aside of a day for worship and for rest, makes all the difference. It is a participation in the rhythms of creation itself. And then it seemed good to us to end this series here with Isaiah, to speak about what it is all about, and that is encounter. Hearts and minds that are open to the experience of the Holy One. And I've been suggesting each of these Sundays that whenever there is renewal in the church, it is often either led by or always accompanied by a renewal in worship. God's people opening their hearts again to the power and the presence of God. God's people leaving their narcissistic ways and coming together in worship and then going out to their places of prayer and their worship through the week with hearts and minds that are open to the beauty and the power and the loveliness and the goodness and the light that is without darkness. And that He whom we worship, whom we will become like over time. And so this morning I just want to ask, what would be true of us as we are a people who experienced a renewal in worship? I think a renewal in worship would mean moving from being consumers of religion to being worshipers of the living God. I think a renewal in worship would mean that we are not observers, that all of us together, are, as Dawn has said this morning, are the choir. We're the team on the field. We are the orchestra who are playing. We are the doers. A renewal in worship would mean that we realize that it's not about us. It means that we come together expectantly, anticipating that we will lift our eyes off our poor narcissistic selves. How ironic this is. Our greatest needs are met when our eyes are lifted off of our narcissistic selves. And we contemplate the beautiful one, the magnificent one, the one who is good and righteous and just and pure. A renewal in worship will mean that we will be a genuinely humble people. Humble because when you contemplate the beauty of God, you become far more aware of the darkness and the shadows of your own life. Goodness, maybe the reasons that we love gossip is because they make us feel a little bit better about who we are. When we turn our eyes in the opposite direction in worship, suddenly we become that we are aware of the one, that we are the ones with darkness and shadow and need, and we are the ones who need, bring our needs for confession to worship. Renewal in worship would mean that we never take forgiveness lightly. We would recognize that forgiveness is the fiery, hot gift of God. We would recognize that forgiveness comes through the fiery, hot cross of Jesus, and we would never take that lightly. A renewal in worship would mean that we would be open, always, always open, to the very course of our lives being changed. As it was with Abraham and Moses and Sarah and Miriam and Mary Magdalene, it won't be any different for us. If we want status quo, let me recommend herbal tea. But not worship. A renewal in worship will mean that we ourselves embody the holiness of the character of God more deeply. It will also mean, and I must warn you here, a renewal in worship will mean very uncomfortable times when we are aware that our holiness is filthy rags compared to Jesus, the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. A renewal in worship would mean growing deeper and moving further into the heart of God. A renewal in worship would mean that we find that more and more and more we are in need of the prayer of the tax collector, Lord, have mercy upon me, a sinner. Because the closer we move toward the heart of God, the more we are aware of the shadows of ourselves. A renewal in worship would mean a renewal in service. Remember Isaiah? Here I am, Lord, send me. I'm ready. Worship is always a two-step dance. It is us coming before God, and it is God sending us into the world. And a renewal in worship would mean that we recognize that the real worship leader is always the Holy Spirit. This is wonderful news. We're not making something up. We're not trying to force it to happen. We're simply joining into what the Trinity is already doing. The Spirit is already lifting praise and glory and honor and declaring the beauty of the living God. And when we worship well, we simply join into what the Spirit is already doing. We're part of the song that the Trinity is singing. This is our invitation. This is our call. And this morning, as your pastor, I ask you, are you ready to be a congregation that is about renewal in worship? Are you ready to be a congregation that is dazzled by the beauty of God? You ready to be a congregation that is ready to lay aside our narcissistic selves and to walk into the presence of the living God humbly and obediently and worshipfully? If you are, let's worship together.